Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado. No wonder Chevy Silverado is the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. And if we hear madness in our house, right, that must mean Dennis Rodkin. You have your own theme. Heidemann is really working on the theme music lately. Yeah. So,
is it the madness part or the Our House part?
I think it's the Our House part, but I don't want to speak for him. It might be either. All right, so we were just talking off the air, not to spend too much time on it, but you just came back from a great trip to Ireland, right? I was just back, and we're talking about different neighborhoods. When you walk around as a real estate guy and you walk around a foreign or unusual area, do you have that real estate chip in your head?
You know, I try not to because I try to be on vacation. Yeah, I think anybody who goes on vacation and likes a place starts pulling up the real estate listings.
Right.
I kind of make a point of not doing
that. So you didn't do it at all?
No, I didn't.
What a wasted experience then.
I'm sorry, Steve. I'm so sorry. I could tell you five great houses to buy in Dublin for your next trip.
But you had a great trip, and that's what's important.
I did, yeah. I was out in the countryside hiking most of the time. You had a more urban trip.
We had an urban trip, the hiking trip, and we had a dry trip.
Yeah. Well, you definitely got the advantage over me. I was in a rain poncho soaked to the bone.
Okay. I used to live, jumping into this now, I used to live at Belden and Dayton. Okay, so It's right off the seminary there, and you've got a story about a row house, and I think it's right around the corner from right from
I
there.
I think it would be, yeah.
That is going for, and you know what else? When they shot the movie Stuart Smalley, I'm smart enough, brave enough, blah blah blah. They shot it right on that block, and they used the stoop on Belden.
Oh,
and I just wonder if it's the same one. Anyway, there's this row house on Belden for sale for over $900,000. And it's got apparently a distinct feature.
Yeah, they'll throw in the squatters for free.
How can that be?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, Steve, I've been covering real estate a long time. I look at virtually everything that's listed. I hadn't noticed this in other listings, and all of a sudden this one pops up. I should say, I hadn't noticed this in expensive listings. This is a $990,000 listing, not a $50,000 condo in a nearly vacant neighborhood.
A Tony neighborhood.
A really nice neighborhood and a great old building built in the 1880s. And the listing, all of the write-up, which usually says, nice fireplaces, great view, said, we think there are people who live in here. And then, a million caveats, no guarantees, there are no leases, essentially saying, if you buy this place, you're taking the squatters too.
But the way it's listed, it's like it's uncertain in the listing.
Yeah,
but
I think
they must know.
Well, I spoke to the real estate agent, and he doesn't know. He feels very, very strongly. He said, we've never come face-to-face with them. We've been there day and night, lots of different times. I think it's essentially trying to do a sneak attack and catch up with these people.
Right.
Never actually came face-to-face with them, but had evidence. I have been in buildings where there are squatters. I did a story five years ago, about some foreclosures. And you walk in, and you see that a squatter has been there. They're cup of soup boxes
and stuff.
And an old ratty mattress. So I think probably they feel strongly that there are people there and they just want to, he said, we need to disclose everything to everybody. So if you're the buyer, you need to know you are likely to be dealing with, but we can't say for sure you're dealing with squatters.
The property's owned by a bank right now?
It's owned by a bank, yeah.
I don't understand. I mean, it's quirky and interesting to me, but I don't understand how can they not secure the building or...
Well, there.
Let me ask you one other question before you get there. The former owner was a single woman or something like that?
Yes.
The way I read your story, is it possible that it's her?
You're a sleuth. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. It does happen. It has happened many times that foreclosed owners are still in there sometime after the foreclosing lender takes over the property because, I'm just mad at you. I feel that it is you,
right,
the bank,
this is
that
my
caused
house,
my problem.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Right.
And there have actually been TV episodes about that sort of thing. But going back to I think the bank did secure the property, but this is a 19th century building. Who knows that there's not some weird little back entrance through the basement, that sort of thing. Especially during the downturn, there were a couple of novels I read that had squatters in them that took place in houses with squatters in them. And there's some sort of back way, we only go in at night and it looks as if the plywood is attached, but it's not, that sort of thing. Right. Squatters, you know, you're taking a considerable risk being a squatter, and I think they can be pretty sneaky.
It's just a fascinating story. And I haven't lived there in almost 20 years, but I lived in, there also was a sort of a, what I think was kind of a halfway house on that block too. Mm. Anyway, so read more about that at chicagobusiness.com from Dennis Rodkin. The number of foreclosed homes in the area is dropping, right? Have we reached a low since the housing crisis?
The number of foreclosed homes is dropping, but what we've got out today is that the number of homes sold as foreclosures is dropping. So the you know, a lot of houses are sold conventionally. I'm moving and I sell it to you. But the foreclosed homes being sold by lenders or third parties that have taken them over, that dropped below 1,000 in September for the first time since early 2009. Early 2009 is when they first started separating the sales, so we don't know exactly when, but it has been over 1,000, and most of the time over 2,000 sales a month. Now they're down below 1,000, and the reason that's significant is, well, one reason it's significant is it does seem that the foreclosure crisis is moving behind us, though it's not over. But the other thing is they have less of a footprint all the time on the price of your conventionally
right.
sold
so
home.
So the fewer foreclosed homes being sold, the more valuable my home would be.
Yeah, we
or
have
the better price I could get for my home.
Yes, we have developed into sort of two separate marketing tracks over the course of the past few years. Mostly, it's true that foreclosure buyers are not looking at conventional homes. That's not always true. It's most often true. A couple of years ago, there were so many foreclosures that if you were selling a conventionally sold home, you were being competed with by the foreclosures up and down your block.
That's Dennis.
It's not as true now.
Dennis Rodkin writes for Crane Chicago Business. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to go rent a house together. That's on the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN 1223. Dennis Rodkin is here. Writes for Crane Chicago Business, talking about real estate. And so a couple of stories out today or this past week or so about renting versus buying. And, you know, you tend to think of people who rent homes as people who can't afford to buy a home. Now, there's a lot of other things involved in buying a home, I guess. But you're out with a story that says it's actually cheaper to own a home than it is to rent a home. Explain that for me.
It is. Well, you know, this is a calculation that certain real estate services do constantly as prices change, as interest rates change, other factors. And the thing that I found interesting about this one that was out last week from Zillow is that interest rates would have to essentially, they'd have to go up to the 12% range for owning to be cheaper than renting in the Chicago area. And we didn't, they'd have to get to where interest rates were in the early 90s. We have had, as you know, this long era of low, some people would say artificially and hurtfully low interest rates, but interest rates would have to go up to a point that we haven't seen in 25 years.
So what are we talking about? We're talking about just the monthly nut? I mean,
yeah, they
if you're
do.
Buying a house, you're putting out the down payment, the insurance, and all of that stuff too.
Well, most of these calculations incorporate all that.
They
it's
do.
Boiled down to a simple number. It's not just your house payment would be, but it figures
right.
in a standard down payment, standard mortgage size, that sort of thing. And with the, and it, partly because our prices are so low, our home prices are so low compared to those in other cities, and also because we have all these luxury rentals jacking rents up, it is cheaper, significantly cheaper. I think it's 37% cheaper on a monthly basis
so
to own than to rent.
If you've got someone like a kid coming up out of college and buying, they're better to buy a house. Then it'd be more affordable for them to buy a house than to rent an apartment or a house.
It would be more affordable to buy than to rent. But if you're a young adult and don't know, if you know I'm going to be here in Chicago and I'm going to be in this part of Chicago for the long term, then buying is a great idea. But if you're likely to follow a job to another city, buying is not as good an idea because we have some difficulties.
If you are in Oak Park or many of the western suburbs, the rents are going up.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. Another study showed that the biggest rent increase predicted that the biggest rent increases in the next year are all going to be in suburban and nearly suburbs and nearly suburban parts of the city, like Mount Greenwood and things like that. Oak Park being one where the increases are supposed to be the biggest. One of the reasons for that is that the big increases have already hit downtown and in near neighborhoods. And that apparently is also true. They pulled this data just for us, so we can't say what's going on in all cities, but Zillow is based in Seattle, and they also have data for Seattle, and they say the same thing is going on there. High rent increases downtown, starting to push people who can't cover that out toward the suburban areas. And so the people in the suburbs or in these places like Mount Greenwood that are nearly suburban who own the properties realize, wow, I can get a lot more. I've had so many more people look at this apartment, so they demand
more rent.
Pushes the price up.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So
it's sort of the next wave. I can't afford these big downtown rent increases. I'll look at the next place, and the foot traffic in that next ring jacks prices up.
Okay, real quick. You also had a story about demolitions in Chicago.
Yeah.
That they're down. And there are a couple of reasons why they're down, right? The economy's picking up. The home values are going up.
Right.
But the city's also got this program of trying to steer what would have been demolished buildings into other hands. Explain that for me.
It's mostly been a pilot program. There are about 60 buildings that have been saved so far. There are another 175 in the process right now. The city is trying to just look at alternatives to demolishing buildings. They demolish buildings that are dilapidated, that are attracting crime and drugs and that sort of thing. If they can determine that it's not a danger to the neighborhood and it is savable, and they can find a third party, in one case, it was a group that provides housing to nearly homeless veterans families. In a couple of other cases, it was for-profit developers who would rehab.
Right.
You know, if you can get this property for free or for the cost of taxes, it's cheaper in the end for you to rehab.
And as the city points out, that if it's torn down, it's not going to be rebuilt.
Yeah.
Right? If it's in an area where it's going to be torn down, someone isn't going to go in and build a new building there. So let's save the structure.
Exactly. We've both had the experience of seeing a lot of those neighborhoods on the south side where blocks and blocks of vacant lots have sat vacant for year after year after year. And they may be better than buildings that squatters can move into and drug dealers can move into and that sort of thing. But if you want the neighborhood to be thriving, stabilized, whatever kind of word you want to use, then keeping those buildings intact and putting people in them, if rehabbing is financially viable, is another alternative.
Dennis Rodkin from Crane Chicago Business. Read more at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. We're in the Allstate Showcase studio along Michigan Avenue. Elise Glink is on a phone line. She is the co-host of the Monday Morning Marketing Podcast that you can listen to, subscribe to at WGNplus.com. Elise, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Hey, Steve. Thank you.
All right, so I'm just tooling around thinklink.com and I'm trying to come up with a financial question that's not answered on that website. It's pretty amazing the material you have there.
It's a lot of years of a lot of information, all combined, free and open to the public on money and real estate stuff.
And it's a big day for you, right? You're revamping the website?
We are. We are attempting to go live, and like everybody else who tries to relaunch their website, there's a last-minute hiccup or two. But I think by the end of the day, we'll have a new look and feel up and running, and it's all built and should work beautifully for
you
people.
Know, honestly, I have not been on it in a while, and if you have any sort of financial question, whether it has to do with the mortgages or real estate lawyers or anything like that, it's all there, estate planning. But I know also that you send out a couple of newsletters and you're sort of giving them a redesign.
We are, because I think that when you look at branding, you know, your website is kind of the starting point for that, or rather I should say your logo is the starting point for that. So for most companies, you redo your logo and then you decide your website needs a refresh. But what do the communications look like that you're pushing out to your customers or your clients or even your employees? And for branding to be effective, you really want it from top to bottom to look, feel, and sound exactly the same way. That's how it becomes more powerful.
It's so you create newsletters and help other companies with their newsletters. I wonder if it's sort of the doctor treating herself as the patient, if it's a little difficult doing it for your own newsletters.
You know, it's always easier to clean out somebody else's closet because you just don't have the emotional attachment to that pair of boots from the 1970s that you only pull out once a year,
maybe
on Halloween.
They're coming back.
They're coming back. But when it comes to newsletters, and we are doing this for our two newsletters, our Monday newsletter and Thursday newsletter, what I wanted to do was put a spin on them so that they would feel as fresh and as interesting as the website. Because when we promote the different stories that we're putting up on our websites, and somebody gets that in the newsletter, when they click through, I want them to have the same customer experience
right.
that they're having in the newsletter that they have on the website, so that it really cements in their mind.
One of the suggestions you have for people who are working on a newsletter or communication like this, and it's I think sometimes it's the hardest, it's to figure out what the goal is of the particular document, of the newsletter or whatever. And I think sometimes we put things out and we don't really consider, well, what is it exactly that we're trying to convey here?
You know me, after all these years of talking to you and being on your show, I'm so big about strategy. So having a goal for a newsletter is just as important as having a goal for a website or even having sales goals, right? It gives you something that's actionable and something you can point at, and then you can reverse engineer from the goal through the strategy to where you need to start out. And so if the goal of your newsletter is to get people to sign up for a webinar, that's what should be the goal. Everything that goes into that newsletter should point to that goal. If the goal is to get let people know there's new coupons out there that they can use today, click on and they'll get something, or if they forward the newsletter to somebody, they'll click on and get something, then your whole goal of the newsletter should be around that. If it's just information and you want people to click on those pieces of information, you should do that. And so understanding who you're trying to get at and what the response is going to be, the desired response, is going to be key to creating a newsletter that's solely pointed at that goal.
I think one of the keys as well is, you know, it used to be you'd create a newsletter or some sort of document, and you'd put it in the mail, and it relied then on the envelope or the logo to get people to open it up and read it. Now, it's really, it doesn't matter how beautiful your newsletter is, for me anyway, it's all about the subject line. I mean, I get hundreds of emails every day, and I kill 98% of them by giving the subject line not even a full look, but a momentary look. You got to have a good subject.
You do, and you also have to have a trustworthy name that it's coming from. So people go to thinklink.com, so when they get a thinklink.com newsletter, it's not a big surprise.
That's a good
point,
yeah.
Really Elise Glink behind it. Or when you send out your newsletter, Steve, about travel, you want the subject line to be trustworthy and interesting to them, right? Like say, oh, I don't know, about Ireland, for example. And then if that's something they're interested in, they're going to click on it. Or if you have upcoming trips, and they know that they really want to take a trip with you, then they know that inside that newsletter they are expecting to see information
about Iceland in June.
Exactly, or wherever you're going in September or October of next year.
Tell me about the screenwriter's trick of, because I'm interested in this, it makes a lot of sense to me, of writing a scene by starting in the middle. And maybe that's the same sort of thing we're talking about. You hook someone with a subject line, you hook them with the substance first, and then flesh out the story later.
Right. So I started my career as a screenwriter, not a very successful one, but I did. And one of the tricks that we learned is, and if you watch television, you'll see this, or movies, when you enter a scene, it's never right at the beginning of the scene. Something's already happening when you sort of, you know, peer in on it. I think newsletters are most effective when you do the same sort of trick. You want to kind of get to a newsletter and assume that people are intelligent enough to catch up to where you are. And you don't have to start at the beginning. And by the beginning, it might mean, hi, I'm Elise Glink. I'm the publisher of thinklink.com, and we offer this kind of personal information. You just assume that people already know that, and so you hop into what's going to be interesting to them, and that's why the subject line's important, the first sentence is important, and where you put the clicks, the links into the newsletter body is important as well.
So if you can get them to get engaged with the idea, they will learn about that sort of expository information a little bit later on.
Exactly. You don't want to insult anybody's intelligence. And then in a typical newsletter list, there are going to be people that are going to open it up every week. And I hear from people every week. They say, oh, I learned so much in this week's newsletter. Or, oh, I have a question about that popped into my mind from it. So you want to have engagement metrics in there, right? What are you measuring? How can people reach back to you? Again, what's the goal? For me, the goal is information. I want to make you smarter about your money every single day. And so I'm interested in you reading what I have, clicking on it, going to the website, and answering, you know, any questions that you might have. But if somebody else wants to sell you something in their newsletter, which might be perfectly legitimate, you want to make sure that they know where to go and how to buy that thing that you're trying to sell them. And understanding the logic of how people read newsletters is super important.
How do, and you talk about, and this is the difference between you and me, where I might put something out and hope for the best. And you talk about putting something out and then testing it and testing it again to figure out what worked and what didn't. How do you engage in that testing?
So it's pretty interesting. We've recently moved from Constant Contact to MailChimp, which we really like. I like how they charge. I like how easy it is. It's designed by a couple of guys who used to write newsletters for companies, and they built this entire software platform around it. And I'm not a spokesman for them. I just happen to really like them. And they make it very easy to do A-B, what we call A-B testing, right? So you're going to divide your list in half or in thirds, and maybe you'll try a subject line on the first third, a different one on the second third, and a different one in the third. And what you're going to do is send out the newsletters, and maybe the whole body is the same, but it's just those subject lines that are different. And you're going to see how well they open. And then the next time you run a newsletter, you're going to take the same subject line, but the inside of the newsletter, you're going to change one thing. And a really successful A-B test is every time you do it, you only change one thing. And that's how you learn what's making the difference. If you do two totally different newsletters, it's going to be hard to identify what's the winning formula.
At least, Glink, so we talked about your newsletters. Can people sign up and get those?
They can. If you go to thinklink.com or bestmoneymoves.com, there's a sign up for our newsletter button on both of those sites, and you can sign up for free, and they come out once a week each.
All right, real quick, go to thinklink.com now, and then go in this evening, and you can get a little before and after picture.
That's right. You'll have your own A-B test, and you can tell me which version of the website you like best.
Great to talk to you, Elise.
You too, Steve.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Twelve fifty-one. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Alex Picios is in the studio. He's the president of Cinespace, which is a pretty remarkable thing for a variety of reasons. But Alex, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the obvious. Now, Cinespace is in North Lawndale, right? You've opened up these sound stages. You're all the Chicago Fire, Chicago, all these shows are made out there, right?
Yes, all of them. We have all the Dick Wolf shows.
You came first.
Yes, we came first. We opened up actually 5 years ago this month.
And so what is it that gave you this idea to do it? And how successful have you been?
Oh, it's been great. So, well, my uncle Nick, who started Cinespace in Toronto 30 years ago, he's the largest film studio operator in Canada. 5 years ago, I wanted to do something different because I was in the real estate business here, and things
went. How was that going?
It did not go well at all. So the uncle came in, and we started looking at properties, and when Ryerson Steel was a steel mill, and a large one, 1.5 million square feet, over 60 acres.
Right.
And he saw the opportunity, and I saw it too, and we started with one stage, which is for the show Boss with Kelsey Grammer.
Sure, sure.
And we haven't stopped, and now we're up to 30 stages.
At 30 stages, and how many of them are actually being used?
Right now, all of them.
All of them are being used?
Yes.
What is it that's bringing people to Chicago, but then to you?
Two things. The most important thing is the Illinois State tax credit. I mean, it's a good credit, and the studios in L.A. Believe in it, and it works. And then for us, it was being able to house these shows and also being able to have lighting companies and camera companies and post-production companies and casting companies move here, buy into what we wanted to do in Chicago. And it's working.
But they've tried it. Alex, they tried it from time to time. They had the, Oprah area. She had the studios there. They brought shows in, and things would go well for a while, and then they would fizzle out. How come you succeeded?
Yeah, it really is. It's a service business, and we've been in business for 30 years, and Cinespace really does have a strong name in Los Angeles with the studios. Uh-huh. We're very well respected, and as of this week, there's four more shows that have been calling me that want to come. Feature films and two television shows.
And so we know about the Dick Wolf shows. What else is made
out there? And then you have Empire Shoots by Us, which is Fox's number one TV show. We also have a new show called APB, All Points Bulletin, which will be airing soon. Exorcist with Gina Davis is shooting there.
Mm-hmm.
And The Patriot, which is Amazon Studios production.
Okay, so then two more things I want to talk to you about. You're in North Lawndale. not the most glamorous or glitzy part of the city of Chicago. But people have no trouble making the trek there to do the work, right? Mm-hmm. And you're having a great impact on the neighborhood. Tell me about that sort of relationship.
Yes, you know, that we're I'm proud of that more than anything. So in the neighborhood there, we've really worked on trying to hire locals. I would hire them, bring them on with CineSpace, and then the ones that really were hungry, I would push them into the union, you know, and say, hey, guys, these guys are willing to work, and they're all local guys, you know, right. And we're really proud of that. And we also do a lot of outreach in the community from our CineSpace charities, paying for kids' colleges in the neighborhood, kids that couldn't afford to go to college, and reaching out to the community.
Okay, so there's that. And then you have not just the plan to make TV shows and movies there, you want to turn it into sort of a backlot tourist attraction.
That's right.
That's a big plan.
Yeah, it's a big plan, but it's happening. We're really
close.
You
got a smile on your face.
It's exciting.
It's going to happen?
No, it's going to happen, yeah.
What is it? What's your vision there?
So the vision there is almost like in Los Angeles, we're going to fence in the whole property. We're going to take the facades of the buildings and actually build Chinatown, New York, London, and Main Street, USA. And what we're going to do is tap into Lagunitas Brewery, which is my tenant there. Had over 400,000 people tour it last year. So they had to come through the studio.
So you got the people there, yeah.
So they're coming there. So yeah. I figured there was something to tap into, and we're excited about it.
And so these outdoor streets will be tour spots, or will they be functional for
both,
film as well?
For both. Yeah. It'll be great. For shows like Empire that is set in New York, we'll actually have a New York
scene, mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, did you think 5 years ago when you were in real estate that you would be here today?
No, not at all. Not at all.
So I guess we've talked a little bit about what the future is, right? But what do you see? Has there been a peripheral draw? I mean, are other studios in Chicago benefiting from you, or do you have competition? I don't even know.
No, we don't have too much competition. But what we have seen, though, is many other auxiliary companies are moving to Chicago. There's a lighting company called VER that just took 100,000 square feet down the street. Yeah. There's another camera company, Panavision, took 90,000 square feet. So it's drawing more businesses to come.
Okay, so we're about out of time, but you know, all we hear about is what a drag it is to do business in Illinois, and now it's such a terrible climate. You seem to be taking off. What's the difference? Is it just that credit you're talking about, the tax credit?
Yeah, the tax credit and you know, the city and the state of, you know, they really want these productions to come, and they're great engines for jobs and revenue. I mean, 7,500 film-related jobs since we opened up 5 years ago, and over $3 billion in revenue.
So do you go home at night, make a bowl of popcorn, sit in front of the TV and say, hey, that's me. I made that. That's mine.
No, I don't do that.
Yes, you do. I can see that you do.
No, there's more to come. More to come.
Alex Pizzios, thanks for coming by. Let's do it again. I want to talk to you more.
Thank you very much.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN.